Buongiorno, Toby.
Arrivederci.
Como estai? I'm Andrew Marzoni.
I'm Toby Wilson Bates.
And this is The Office Hour.
So today, we're going to be talking about Elena Ferrante.
Hence the Italian-themed vocabulary words.
Was mine Italian?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, it was inappropriate, but it was Italian.
So, this is my plan. I'm thinking, after reading a few articles, I read one in The New Yorker by Alexander Schwartz and one in The New York Times by Rachel Donadio about the unmasking of Elena Ferrante. I thought, wow, this is a real mess. Like, I feel like the reading that I've done is just people randomly throwing pieces of information at a larger piece of information. So I figured let's each come up with kind of three things that might be useful for sorting this out, and we'll go through those things.
That sounds like a good idea. Did you read the original, the article in the NYRB?
No, I actually didn't.
This is great. Okay, full disclosure, Toby and I are very ill-informed on the like actual substance of this debate, seeing as how neither one of us have read any of Elena Ferrante's novels.
Do you want to briefly say what the thing that happened was?
Yeah, okay. So we should start here very briefly. Elena Ferrante has been writing novels under the name Elena Ferrante, which is a pseudonym, for about 20 years, which has only become an issue really recently in the past few, because she wrote a series of four novels that are kind of being called the Neapolitan Quartet, or I read elsewhere the Napolitiad. I don't know how to pronounce that.
You just crushed that. That was
perfect. But so these novels have had wild success and been translated into many languages and been bestsellers all around the world. So an Italian investigative journalist named Claudio Gotti, which I think, as Alexandra Schwartz points out, means Claudio the cat, or rather Claudio the cats to be particular, but whatever. He launched what he calls, in the New York Review of Books piece, a months-long investigation into the true identity of Elena Ferrante, who he argues is a German translator in Rome. Maybe I won't say her name right now, and then we can decide later on whether or not we think it is,
it
like,
ethical. It might not even be her.
It might not even be her, first of all. But, yeah, so that's the... Is there anything else I should... Well, the other thing that I think is relevant that Alexandra Schwartz also pointed out is that the New York Review of Books published this online at, like, 1 a.m. Sunday morning, which is generally when, the real controversial pieces get sort of thrown out onto the internet for public consumption. And as you pointed out, also, he simultaneously published this in various languages. NYRB piece was the English language version, but I believe he also published it simultaneously in Italian, Spanish, German, probably French too. And of course, since then, all of the appropriate outlets have commented on it, as you pointed out, the New Yorker, the New York Times, the Times Literary Supplement. So it's running the whole gamut of literati hot takes.
Yeah, and it strikes me that at least one of the sort of underlying stories is this idea of this sort of insatiable man pursuing and hunting down this woman, trying to hide her identity, becomes sort of almost like a story of sexual aggression. And not that there's actual sex going on here or this sort of thing, but rather that one of the interpretations of this is that she's been kind of violated in her unmasking.
Right. And while I do not hasten to use the phrase gotcha journalism, I feel like, you know, this is definitely a piece that smacks of gotcha journalism.
Yeah, so I've asked you to come with three things that can help us sort this out. Do you want to introduce one of your things?
Well, I think you should go first because I'm still not sure what you mean by things yet. So I'll follow by your example.
So the first one, I was going to bring in a kind of dusty old phrase that kicked around pretty heavily in academia for a while and then I think died a quiet death somewhere, although I don't think anybody will admit this. And this is the author function.
Right.
And so this is Roland Barthes saying, well, really, the figure of the author is sort of this imaginary thing anyway because actually this is a stand-in for lots and lots and lots of people that actually create the thing that we call a text.
Quick distinction, though. It was actually not Barthes who coined the author function.
Oh,
that
really?
Was Foucault. But it's part of the same conversation that Barthes started
with death
in,
of the,
in
author.
The death of the author. But they're you know, they're slightly different arguments, but they are getting at the same, you know, we can call it a truth if we want to, or maybe it's not a truth, that the author is something other than the, you know, flesh and blood writer whose signature is on the page.
Right. It's not, as T.S. Eliot would have it, like the individual genius from whom, like, great works spring, you know, almost entirely from their heads, but rather a long process made out of a lot of different stakeholders who create this thing and then kind of create it over and over again in a sort of cultural appropriation. And this is also one of the terms that I was going to come to later, is this word appropriation, because this is on the other side of people who are now very skeptical, is this idea that if she's not Neapolitan, then she has appropriated stories from that community when she is not of that community. And apparently this is a hot sort of debate right now in writerly communities, whether or not you can appropriate stories that you aren't actually a part of.
Right, the politics of representation. I got the sense reading the Gaudi article that Ferrante is being taken to task for misrepresenting her class. That rather she was the daughter of a magistrate and not the daughter of a seamstress as the protagonist of the Neapolitan novels in this forthcoming autobiography is.
That's interesting. And it strikes me there's also a gender component, because one of the arguments that's been repeated several times is that if this woman is the woman that he thinks she is, then her husband is a writer, and there's also the insinuation that he is actually the one who's the real kind of genius behind the texts rather than her. So in that argument, not only is she someone who hides her own name, but she's also not even the person really doing the thing that she's hiding, which would really make it strange that we're even talking about her at all.
Right. Well, and I think that the reason that this discussion, aside from, you know, fans and critics of Ferrante's work, you know, taking a more singular view of it, I think to me what is so rich about this controversy is the kind of philosophical heft of it.
Yeah.
And this is getting back to the Roland Barthes, Michel Foucault thing, and a sort of more contemporary question is, does anyone have a right to anonymity?
And furthermore, I think as the natural kind of piece connected to that, can we ever really know anyone?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, we can. Okay.
Oh, no. I know. I mean, like, yeah, that is the question. Right. I don't know. I don't think so.
Because it strikes me that this is weirdly also playing out in the American political scene with, you know, Donald Trump's taxes being revealed or Hillary Clinton's emails being revealed. So, okay, now we know this candidate, or like, now we know this candidate. Now we have the truth, so we can really see, as if looking at their policy positions or this sort of thing were utterly meaningless. And if we could just get at like some kind of secret biographical impulse, we could have an insight that we wouldn't normally have, and could also render judgment on these figures. The pieces I've read seem to be reacting very strongly to that exact idea that, like, this woman, if indeed Elena Ferrante is a woman, was attempting to kind of shield herself. And as Alexander Schwartz points out, was foregoing actually promoting her book, or her or his book, we'll say her, I guess, for the moment, because the pseudonym at the very least is feminine, and actually kind of disadvantaging herself by having a pseudonym. So it's clear that in that sense, in the modern book world, she really wanted to protect her identity.
Right. The nuance of Gaudi's language in the NYRB piece definitely seems condescending and dismissive of Ferrante's desires to be anonymous. And I think in the last line that he says something to the extent of apparently she wants to remain unknown. Whereas it's, if you go and look at what she has said in interviews, it's very explicitly rendered that she wants to remain unknown. There's no apparently about it.
And it's worth saying, anonymity has done a lot over the years. Like, a lot of the texts that I study are actually, at least initially, published anonymously. Like, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein was published anonymously. And it's caused a great deal of kind of back and forth, because so many people argued for, like, over a century that Percy Shelley probably wrote the thing rather than Mary. And at least the most recent version of this argument I've seen coming off of various early manuscript editions is that it's relatively clear that Percy Shelley made the book worse than it would have been otherwise. Mm-hmm. Like, all of his edits are kind of garbage and really pedantic. Another book that I am a huge fan of, and I don't think gets nearly enough play, is Lord Byron's Don Juan.
Oh, yeah.
Which was also published anonymously initially because it was pornography.
Right.
And because it was published anonymously and out of copyright because it was pornography, it distributed hundreds of thousands of copies of this thing, because any publisher would take it and copy it and then print it anonymously. So it interestingly is also a form of kind of mass dissemination.
But what I wanted to talk about is the kind of clear precedent for me here is Thomas Pynchon. Mm. And although Thomas Pynchon publishes under what we at least know to be his real name, he has done a very good job of remaining hidden from the public eye for the last, 60 years, aside from little things here and there. For instance, he was in an episode of The Simpsons with a bag over his head. But all this to say, there was a similar expose about Thomas Pynchon years ago that concluded that his wife is a high-powered literary agent and basically sort of exposed his identity, even though the name Thomas Pynchon was never on the line. And I think that this is the real distinguishing factor here, right? Is that this is about naming names. Mm-hmm. Which has, a violence in American history, certainly, right? Thinking about, like, the McCarthy era and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
There's an outing here, which strikes me as violent and aggressive, but at the same time, I think that the idea of a writer or, to that extent, any kind of celebrity in 2016 expecting to remain anonymous is completely absurd. It's a lofty ideal that I admire, but, I mean, thinking about it from a journalistic perspective, the truth has to come out.
Yeah, it makes me think a little bit about those Google trials in Europe, where people were trying to get themselves erased off of Google searches.
Uh-huh.
And the first guy who filed the suit is now, like, one of the easiest people to find on Google, because his case became the case to argue the whole thing. So
that's an unfortunate irony.
Right, yeah, that he made himself incredibly searchable by fighting being searchable. And it strikes me that, I mean, and I don't know. I mean, these worlds operate in unusual ways, but it strikes me that if she just waits, and it seems like this is what she's doing, the news cycle will just cycle, and in a couple weeks, this will just be that thing that happened a couple weeks ago.
And I don't imagine that it's going to harm her literary career. I mean, I think, if anything, the fact that I can't think of any other contemporary Italian writers that have made such a big splash on the international market, the fact that she was able to do that without, being a part of the press mechanism is remarkable. I mean, I guess you could make the argument that that the mystique is alluring, but no one that I know who has read and loved the Ferrante novels, and I know many people, has pointed to, like, the elusiveness of the author's identity. Like, if anything, I think that's a thing for Pynchon that people really like. But Ferrante, it's all about, the prose and the world that she creates.
And it strikes me that in this way, and this is maybe a way to bring back around this author function thing that is potentially useful a little bit here, that if the author is able to, at least in some meaningful way, remove his or her, or we might say itself, as the author figure, from one's engagement with the text, that allows you to engage the text on sort of more interesting terms than if it's bogged down by, like, oh, well, this is J.K. Rowling's pseudonym. Like, is this influenced by, like, the Harry Potter universe when she's writing a detective novel or something like that, right? Like, if you're able to actually just have a function in the space of the author rather than a biographical human being who's part of, like, I don't know, celebrity press, then maybe the book can just be a book.
Right. And I mean, I think that one of the intentions of that whole discourse in the late 60s about the death of the author and the author function was to reveal the ways in which reading is a creative process, mm-hmm. and the ways in which readers are themselves authors. So I guess the question here is whether that creative effort of the reader is being diminished somehow in the revealing of this information.
Yeah, and it's worth saying, it's really interesting to think about this in terms of genealogies, right? Like, that to what degree do we link this to a tradition leading up to it? I had a friend years ago in a class talk about how problematic Brokeback Mountain is as potentially one of the most kind of vibrant and popular representations of homosexuality by a straight director with two straight lead male actors.
Right.
Where it's like, well, is this in the tradition of Stonewall? Do we want to think about this as part of a tradition that, like, pushes back against heterosexual norms? Despite the fact that, you know, these people aren't necessarily part of that community in the real world. Like, is that appropriation okay? Should we treat that as if it has arisen out of a community that none of the people are actually interacting with?
I was thinking, too, about this. Have you seen this new Werner Herzog documentary?
No, is it good?
The one about the internet. And there's a part where he interviews this family whose daughter died in a pretty tragic way,
mm-hmm.
but they didn't know how tragic it was until photographs of their daughter's body surfaced online, and anonymous people from all over the internet started emailing them these photos relentlessly.
Wow.
So, you know, I think that this problem of anonymity is a much bigger problem of this, you know, kind of interconnected digital world that we have, that has, you know, a bright side, I guess, in terms of its potentialities for doing stuff artistically, you know, not only with Elena Ferrante, but even with someone like Banksy, right?
Mm.
Or even Daft Punk with the helmets, right? Even though we all know who they are and what they look like. But
or
on
or
the
Sia
other hand...
might be the other example.
What's that?
Sia?
Yeah, Sia, right? Or there's Anonymous, the hacker group. I'm not saying anything of substance right now, but what I guess what I'm trying to get at is I feel like aside from the just general popularity of Ferrante's novels, this affair is getting at a particular anxiety that is central to kind of culture at the moment. And also something that's kind of a trope in literary fiction, too. Like, Schwartz in The New Yorker mentions Charles Kinboat in the Nabokov novel Pale Fire. There's also, I was thinking about that Henry James novella The Aspirin Papers, which seems to be a very similar situation. And then, of course, in Roberto Bolaño's 2666. The whole thing is framed around these sort of four self-indulgent academicians' quest to find out as much information as they can about this impossibly mysterious writer.
Right.
And that ends up being a novel that is rooted in violence against women, too. So I don't know if I have anything to say except that we've kind of come full circle and we should probably leave it at that. But I'm very excited to see how this thing develops.
That was a beautiful monologue. Oh. I like that.
Really?
I do have one question for you before we finish.
Yeah,
is torturing me for years. Is Werner Herzog, is he actually like a really happy person, or is he actually like the least happy person?
I think that he's incredibly happy. That's my take anyway. I mean, I'm sure he has dark moments like we all do. But I feel like his perspective on life is overwhelmingly optimistic. Perhaps even Buddhist.
The Office Hour is produced by Andrew Marzoni and Tobias Wilson Bates, Britton Fellows in the Writing and Communication Program at Georgia Institute of Technology. To find out more about the topics discussed, see our page at textile.lmc.gatech.edu. Thanks for listening!